kind of hard to concentrate on manifestos in this election because we're in a sort of limbo land where no one seems sure if devolution will be our fixed state for more than the next couple of years. We discuss. We also look at America, where the faith kept by the states during Donald Trump's tenure in the White House means that Joe Biden's been able to hit the ground running on climate change, especially important on Earth Day. And we look at community wealth building, another example from the States that could have massive application here, especially in Glasgow. Those are the headlines. Now for the podcast.
Hi, Johnson. Welcome to this week's Leslie Riddick podcast, which, believe it or not, is the 201st since Leslie and I started doing them together. It was the 200th last week, getting the heady excitement of the manifesto launches that were going on all over the place. I totally missed it. It was only when I was actually setting up some stuff for this week I noted that this is the 201st this week.
And I'm
and I'm thinking back to
so
the very...
Almost in the spirit of the 701st Declaration of Arbroath Festival. You see, it's cool to have something 01, I think, now, given last year's sort of, you know, difficulties. But anyway, good.
Just reflecting on it, the very first one was about the pharaohs, believe it or not. And my total contribution, I think, throughout was going, oh, that's interesting. Oh, that's really interesting. That's interesting. And for many people, that was probably the best way to do it. It was a whole lot of Leslie. But anyways, here we are. Last week was a whole load of manifestos. This week, I mean, I was ploughing through the Green Manifesto, which is a substantial document, looking through the SNP Manifesto yet again. Alaba launched its manifesto yesterday, and we'll talk about its launch possibly in a moment. And I was talking to Leslie about this, and I had this terrible feeling of ennui. And am I the only person in the world who's actually bothering to look through manifestos when there's only one issue?
Yeah. And this is kind of what I ended up writing the National column about yesterday. I mean, I wrote it yesterday for today, today being Thursday. That we're just stuck in this kind of limbo land, basically, in this really unsatisfactory position where what we're having at the moment is only, you know, is only sort of passably able to be called a proper election. I just can't remember a time when the leaders of every other party have conceded they're going to lose. Actually, 6 weeks out from polling even, you know, nobody's going for gold here except the SNP. Now, obviously, a lot of people will say, well, great, you know, spare us all the protestations we used to get from the likes of Jim Murphy that he was going to be the next first minister, when quite patently that wasn't going to happen. But the fact that it almost cannot happen, I mean, you know, again, a lot of independent supporters will think, well, thank God for that. You know, there's nae wee unionist hands going to get their hands on the kind of levers of power at Holyrood. But this is not normal. You know, this is not like normal democracy to be in this sort of stuck position. And it is stuck for better and worse. And it's both if you're an independent supporter, because we have really reached the limits of what you can do with devolution. We're stuck, as I say, limbo land, where the belief in Westminster, I think, has just evaporated. And we might come on to the string of stuff that happened in just one day, you know, yesterday. Let's give it 2 days to be generous of just, you know, stuff which in the old days, any one of the scandals that was uncovered just yesterday would have been enough to have started Dukes, you know, have folks speculating about the viability of the government. But you can manage to go through the nonsense of creating a 2.1 million special kind of amphitheatre for your press briefings, then decide, I mean, I think it was just the overwhelming blue, you know, that maybe Boris is kind of beginning to discover is a slightly unnerving thing to be contained within. But, you know, that you're encouraging a focus on yourself that you actually are not able to sustain. So suddenly it's scrapped, you know, almost like who cares? Then we move on to all the stuff about, you know, Dyson and whether or not it was right to kind of promise to fix tax regulations so that Dyson's employees could come into the UK, work here on doing stuff relating to PPE and not have any tax liabilities in the same way as other companies continued to do, albeit within the, you know, new rules of COVID. I'm trying to remember all the other stuff that happened yesterday. A minister resigned. the Home Office regulations on deporting homeless people were declared inhumane. What else? Well, there was another two whoppers. I mean, can you remember?
Nope.
There was just sizable, massive stuff keeps kind of coming running in. So, I mean, any Scot who looks at this, I think, is not going, impressive. That makes me really want to vote for, you know, the Tories. But it's happening in England, you know. So you're seeing both the collapse of any kind of semblance of proper governance in Britain, in London. You're also seeing support for the agents of that collapse increase in England.
Yeah.
So, right, anybody looking at this now has to say this is another country. And so there's a detachment from any belief in Westminster. What we've got in the shape of devolution, well, all right, it was all right when it started, but it's a wee bit like your wee school jacket. You know, you quickly outgrow it, and then you realise why your mum bought one five sizes too big.
You
never realised you were growing at that rate. So, you know, that's where we are with this sort of our small jacket within devolution. And who loves this Parliament? Who loves it as it is? You know, the Bridget Jones test, because it looks like it's really nobody. I mean, the SNP are not in existence to support or to proceed with a devolved parliament. And OK, we can come back on to whether that's become a wee bit convenient, but that's not in their framework of why the party was created. And the parties that are supposedly the parties of devolution, you know, the Tories actually oppose the establishment of the Scottish Parliament and are now completely undermining it. And Labour, you know, wheeled all the kind of useful powers that could have come to us in the wake of IndyRef 1. And those are the supposedly the advocates of devolution. So, you know, this is a topsy-turvy situation. And if you add on to that, ALBA and the Greens making the case in their various ways for a supermajority, when in all likelihood, if the SNP do get a simple majority, they will be sitting on the sidelines the same way the Greens have been for the last God knows how long, because that's what this parliament structure dictates and allows. So, like, I mean, this is not really good enough because everybody's having to go through posturing aplenty in this election. And of course, elections are always about posturing. I get that. But we're sort of betwixt and between, you know, because we haven't got a clear vision of independence to come. We're not hugely enamoured with this toy that seemed quite exciting at the beginning, but now the box looks more interesting. and you know, the status quo has gone. So, you know, to get some dynamism and vigour and to get policies which apply to an actual scenario you want to see happen, we have to move on to IndyRef 2. And I was, you know, really noticing this, some of this was triggered by watching Scotland Tonight, as ever, very, very good programme, always. Andy McKeever, the former Tory advisor, was on, and he was saying exactly the same thing, that, you know, we can't keep having these kind of dull, evasive, lacklustre elections when the real subject, independence, is so large that it basically obscures all policy debate within its shadow, and yet it itself is not properly set up and discussed as if it might be properly happening. So I think that is some of it. And just finally, I was trying to watch the ALBA manifesto launch yesterday as a punter. And as a punter, you discovered that after a couple of minutes of Alex, the whole thing kind of froze on Facebook and YouTube and everything. Yeah. And nobody seemed to realise it was happening. It was a very odd thing. But equally, none of the big media players that you would expect to be delivering absolute pelters for another technical screw up were saying a thing on social media. And I began to wonder if I was just, you know, living in a world of my own with just a problem no one else was having. But I discovered later what was happening is that all the proper media who are, you know, sort of part of the lobby and so on, were given a Zoom link. So see, that brought them straight in. So they had no awareness that the punters were sitting, who were just coming in on other platforms, were not really able to watch what was happening. And in the end, when it was put up, puzzlingly, despite the fact that there is a big full manifesto sitting behind it, there was just 4 minutes and 45 seconds of Alex talking in general terms, you know, slogans and stuff, and not really digging into any of, not pulling out or teasing out anything that was actually the manifesto at all. So I was so kind of confused about that because I'd planned to write about the ALBA manifesto, but then it had actually been put out on embargo the day before, so that most of the hacks, you know, didn't even totally need to be at that mm-hmm. event. And it had been covered already in the day's papers. So, yeah, that I think was mismanaged because, you know, well, apart from the fact that a lot of their own supporters were just, you could see from the comments, were just getting, you know, were just hacked off because they couldn't see it. But it actually, Alex is a really good performer. I mean, why they bothered to have a live part of it, which is the bit that God knows I know yes. jeopardizes everything, because my, you know, everything from the book launch I did to the Estonia film, you know, had problems mm-hmm. when it comes to a live transmission like that, live streaming. And what Alex said could so easily have been part of a sort of pre-recorded film, which yes. could have been sent out on Restream, which is a much more reliable platform. So it's puzzling why you would do that and why you wouldn't get Alex talking more, because let's face it, he is a talker, you know. So as so am I, so I'll shut up now.
Yeah, I mean, oh no, that was it. I mean, precisely. I mean, I was saying to Leslie after I read the article in The National, I mean, the Vulcan mind meld is just about complete, because we'd been discussing about, you know, the election and everything like that. And I was thinking there's only, as I said, there's only one issue. Everything else is trumped by it. And even when I was reading the Green Manifesto and ALBA's manifesto, I thought to myself, there's only one manifesto that really counts, which is the SNP's one. And the Greens have been punting the line that Patrick Harvey was on GMS, the Good Morning Scotland, talking to Gary Robertson. And he was saying, oh, look at the things we've achieved over the past Parliament, where we've got progressive measures put in place and all these things we've done, thus interestingly making an argument why if people don't want to vote Green they should vote ALBA. I thought that goes both ways, Patrick. But it only matters if the SNP are in a minority, and if the mm-hmm. SNP, as you said, are in a majority, no other manifesto is relevant,
because those things that the Greens are chalking up were nearly all achieved at budget time, which yes. is the only time that, you know, essentially you really need. And the rest of the time, I mean, one of the credits they were picking up, which was the, you know, the protection for people, for renters and tenants yes. during COVID, was pretty pushed by Andy Whiteman. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, fine. Mm-hmm. But, you know, just exactly as you say, the second they hit 65 or above, the inbuilt tendency of the SNP and Nicola Sturgeon to go it completely alone mm-hmm. is just not, you know, there's not going to be a whistle, and there never has been. You know, it's the way the SNP hang. You know, they just didn't do collaboration. They didn't, and they didn't do it in the last referendum. They didn't do it in the post period. They don't like the idea of lots of wee hands on the tiller. I think it's part of the reason that they, you know, Nicola's never turned up to All Under One Banner stuff. It's, you know, it's just not in their nature, actually, to be collaborative. So here we are. You know, I mean, people have to go through these kind of exercises. And of course, we should always say you just don't know what the outcome is going to yeah. be. I mean, there's a poll today. It's another Savanta Comrades one, which suggests that the current polling is actually putting ALBA at 2%. But it's suggesting that the SNP would only get 63 seats, which is, I think, where they are, and means they're still short of a kind of mm-hmm. working majority. But Savanta, I think, always have a bit of a record of kind of underestimating the size of Yes support. And I must say, I do think myself that a lot more people will vote ALBA in the end. Partly, I think, because polls have throughout the UK have a historic problem of for whatever reason, underrepresenting working class opinion. Mm-hmm. And that was true. That's where the Corbyn surprise came from, because, you know, and they acknowledged that problem was reason that the polls were completely wrong with him. But for whatever reason, with their sampling, it doesn't seem to err well on taking the whole cross section of society properly. So, you know, I still think that will not be accurate. But nonetheless, here we are, slightly, it feels kind of treading water.
Mm. Well, the other thing was a way to say is that often what these polls don't take into account is lumpy support, where people who are actually thinking and considering voting tactically on the list and the list vote It just depends where this is situated, because that 2% across the whole of Scotland, which they're claiming they've got, might actually be 5 or 6% in Glasgow or Dundee. We just don't know at this point where that support actually lies, whether, as I say, it's lumpy support, which is kind of like what you want in the first past the post system, is lumpy support. So we take that into consideration. But I was actually just thinking to myself that even when I was reading the Alibi manifesto, which contains many interesting things, I thought, well, why am I even bothering to read this, given the SNP stance that they will not in any shape or form or circumstance in a minority, if they require the support of Alibi, accept the support of Alibi in the Scottish Parliament. They say, no way we're going to cooperate with them. So that's that there, whether that would actually be a reality. But I think from what you said before, and I agree with you, I cannot see them cooperating with the Alibi, even if they were in minority. And if the Greens were not able to get them across the line, they're then faced with an incredibly difficult situation in terms of actually with whom do they cooperate. And as Patrick Harvey has been very fond, and Lorna Slater fond, of pointing out, that the budgets, the SNP have cooperated with the Conservatives, of course. I mean, whether that will happen now, because I thought you made a very interesting point in your video piece for the National, Leslie, which was that there is a progressive anti-Conservative majority in Scotland, which has currently been thwarted, as you've said, by the constitutional issue. We cannot get on with developing the kind of modern progressive country that I would say goes across the board, other than the Conservatives and Reform, remember them, the old Brexit party, we can't get on with that because we are trapped within devolution.
And then a constant need to differentiate yourselves when actually there's no differentiation to be made.
Correct.
That's the problem.
Yes.
And, you know, this is always the problem of the false differentiation that comes when you can't talk about the elephant in the room, you know. So with the Tories, it's kind of fairly easy. Just if you actually look through, okay, their manifesto, which is, I mean, I can't see a sort of UK Tory party being able to push some of the things that they were, you know, quite happy with, including this doubling of the Scottish child payment, which, you know, doubtless is designed to try to make them look slightly cuddly and on a vaguely on the wavelength of most Scots, until you look at the accompanying wee documents, which show you that the first time that they schedule in money to pay for that is 2025. So basically it ain't going to happen anytime soon, whereas the tax cuts that they want to put through for the richest, which would leave Uair Dougie himself 1300 quid better off, they come in immediately.
Gosh, what a surprise.
So, I know. So there you are. See, you know, when it comes right down to it, that is what they're like. And again, when you look at their housing proposals, I mean, it just feels like, I don't know, take some thousands, tens of thousands, you know, discuss, put, you know, an arbitrary amount that's going to be affordable on it. Don't discuss how any of that gets built. And then insist on a right to buy alongside it. So you're basically pouring water in one end of the tank and you've got a big blooming hole in the sink at the other end, you know. So aye, plus a change. But these guys are quite good at trying to sort of, fluff it up. But then, of course, they have, you know, the arch fluffer himself standing at the front of it. So it just is completely non-credible. And I mean, the National put a headline on the piece initially, which was a wee bit like, do you think, Tory party manifesto, not much good for Scotland. Aye, that's a bit what we call axiomatic, really. But what I was sort of trying to say was, actually, there is strangely so much consensus really amongst everybody else. I mean, the Lib Dems were the ones that sat and did the maths on how much Dougie would benefit from his own tax cuts. And this is, as we said before, quite relevant. You know, there's a lot of people say, why have you got even the Lib Dems mentioned in any of your columns? You know, let's not take inspiration from Uair Willie. But the point is that here is the kind of consensus that exists on everything, thwarted by one thing, which is not being an independent country. And in the meantime, instead of any debate ever picking up the cross themes of total agreement on stuff, these guys are having to weaken the whole thrust of progressive politics and cohesion by inventing small points of difference that hardly matter.
Yeah.
Or at least not being able to roll them into the bigger things, you know, so that there are real points of difference that are still absolutely worth holding different party political views on. I mean, you know, as per previous, do we want in the future for an independent Scotland one nationalised energy industry? How do we feel about nationalisation these days? How do you square nationalisation with community control?
Correct.
There's loads of proper discussions we need to be having, but ding da bloomin' one of them that ever happens, because everybody's posying away on the corner here with their wee strutty things about, you know, we no recovery without, you know, I can't even sort of manage to mime their stuff anymore. And what a shame, because this just means it's a thin kind of election debate that we're having. I should say, in the midst of all this, if anyone's in the Highlands and Islands, that I'm chairing a hustings at 5 o'clock on Friday that's trying to be a little bit more in the previous vein. It's organised by folk who want to just focus on a vision for the Highlands and see if actually everybody can buy into it and then push it for the whole region. So, you know, there's stuff on social media if you want to try and find about that.
Yeah, because the other thing I got out of that video piece was Boris Johnson's being questioned about misleading Parliament. He was talking about child poverty figures, and the child poverty figures that you came up with were absolutely damning and directly related to George Osborne and the Treasury spotting a little niche in there where they could actually slash welfare benefits through the introduction of universal credit.
Yeah, this was amazing, actually. But this is what you get when you start guddling around and looking at the past, which is a wee point we might come back to. It's amazing. Another bad sign to me of democracy is when people don't even remember what happened 2 years ago. But just looking back to a couple of months ago, a former Work and Pension Secretary, Stephen Crabb, said some very interesting things, and it was triggered by his alarm at the prospect that the Tories would actually not keep up the £20 a week rise in universal credit. So he kind of said in the Commons, you know, looking back, we took too much money out of universal credit. Well, duh. And he then said, and this is an actual quote, that taking too much money out of universal credit is what gives you a lot of the reasons behind the increase in hardship in this country. And he revealed that the Treasury under George Osborne, quote, hated universal credit until it realised it was a mechanism to slash benefits in comparison with the existing tax credit system. So the Treasury only got behind universal credit when it, quote, spotted an opportunity for rolling out cuts to the welfare budget. So this is from the horse's mouth. That's the approach the Tories have had, currently have, to welfare. And that thing about child poverty, I mean, I know the trouble is numbers just, as in every story, you begin to wonder if numbers ever help, you know, because your mind rolls really at it. And you almost need to know what normal is in other countries to just realise how far adrift we are. But, you know, this is the nerve, actually, of Douglas Ross to stand and say anything about poverty in Scotland when it's created so largely by his own government. And, you know, the statistics, 600,000 more kids living in poverty since the Tories came to power, 100,000 in the last year. And the total who are living below the poverty line is 4.2 million youngsters. And just to put that in context, that's about the same population as New Zealand. So, you know, just this is what makes, I mean, I couldn't, if I was having to interview any of these guys anymore, I couldn't do it, you know, because I just don't know how anybody, knowing what's being churned out in our direction by a Tory-led Westminster that looks like it's never going to change, you know, because all the opinion polls have still got Boris so far ahead, all of that being churned in our direction, you know, how dare any Conservative come on and try to sound a little bit progressive for saying that, yes, a bit of mitigation might be in order from his own party.
Yeah. And you see, this leads me then to this point about Anas Sarwar, about Willie Rennie, who are willing to defend a union, which I think in perpetuity has got an inbuilt Conservative majority. Again, our constitutional issue up here, their constitutional issue down there, which has split the country, which is Brexit and people opting into that, and the whole reactionary right wing little Englander English nationalism that it's exacerbated. That's what we're tied into. And how dare Anna Sarwar and Willie Rennie turn around and say, we've got to stick within a union which is allowing Scottish kids to go hungry and people living in poverty. And they're unable, they know we're unable to enact those progressive policies that they claim to support within Scotland because of the union that we are currently part of, and a union that we're being forced to be part of, because again, leading into this, I couldn't believe Douglas Ross's, well, I could believe Douglas Ross's series of responses to Ciarán Jenkins questioning us, if you're not allowing Scotland to have a referendum, what is the legal route to Scottish independence? I mean, and it was just that whole circular thing where Douglas just went into that warp mode and kept repeating himself. He had no answer to it.
It's actually unnerving. You know, it's got the same thing. I think the thing about the Daleks that was always scary in Doctor Who was just because, you know, there was no responsiveness in them. They just trotted out certain lines. I mean, their voices were pretty scary too. And, you know, we could go there with Douglas Ross as well, but we won't. It is the automaton-like response from people is actually completely unnerving in politicians because it isn't human.
Yeah.
You know, it's like you're now watching a machine in action, and completely insults the intelligence of anyone who likes to hear dialogue.
Yeah.
I mean, the whole of human existence is based on our ability to be responsive and to have dialogue with one another. And of course, again, let's not be naive. In an election, there's always times when people turn a bit of a defy to kind of something that's particularly difficult. But it does strike me that, you know, it's just no coincidence that the parties that are actually doing best are the ones which, on the whole, have leaders who try to answer questions.
Yes.
I mean, that's not a really very deep observation.
No.
But the more you end up having to give reflex non-answers to people that sort of insult the intelligence of the average bear, the more people just inch away from you, you know, in general.
Yeah, because I mean, it was I watched Kate Forbes and Andrew Bowie again on Sunday Politics, and it was exactly the same question that Kate Forbes put over, and she was absolutely excellent on this, by the way, incredibly quick, incredibly articulate. I do disagree with her, as many people who support independence and within the SNP on the Growth Commission, and in terms of our currency position post independence. But she was actually asking the same question, which is, what is the legal route? And she came down with the fact that, as I think it was Kieran Martin, whom you talked about last week, turned around and said it's moved from a union of consent to a union that is based entirely upon power of the law. You're not going to have it. I believe that Adam Tomkins, I mean, was he fulminating about this in The Spectator? Did he go into this in any depth about Scotland says no?
Yeah, well, he's written a piece for The Spectator that is currently the most read thing in The National, who've done a wee story about it, which is really saying that this idea of just having a voluntary union needs to go, and that sort of Britain needs to harden up and kind of replace this with a force, so that essentially it's not possible for Scotland to leave. And in it, I mean, I haven't got it right in front of me at the moment, but in it, he's making comparisons with the United States, Canada and Spain. Now, you know, this has actually revealed to me my lack of knowledge, actually, of a lot of the founding conditions of these countries. There's a couple of wee things here. And, you know, my knowledge is not thorough enough to mean that there's not likely to be a small mistake in what proceeds. And doubtless you'll help correct me. But, you know, one of the most important things about Scotland is it has been a separate state.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it joined the state, joined a union with another state to become the United Kingdom. This stands in some contrast to the conditions in Canada and America. When the Constitution was written in 1789 in the United States, there was actually only one precedingly independent state, which was Vermont, which had actually been in its own independent state from 1777. The rest of them had not had that same status of being independent countries for centuries, which Scotland has enjoyed. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's a really, really big difference, one. Difference two is that the founders of the United States, many of them influenced by their experience in Britain, refugees, if you like, from the British experience of just making it up as you go along and ruling everybody from the top with naysay, created a federal system. So, you know, what we've got here is the British government having the best of all worlds by being able to duck and weave, you know, make it up as they go along. And hence things like the Sewell Convention, which we've discovered means hee-haw. The Sewell Convention is the one that says that the British government will not normally, there's the word, intervene in law in devolved areas unless there's prior consent from the devolved governments. And we discovered in the whole Brexit process that's not worth the paper it's written on, that the British government can welly in whenever it feels like it. In stark contrast to the United States, whose federal system has given absolute control over many functions to those states. It's the reason they allowed any claims of statehood to be essentially lost within the constitution that they signed up to. So that's the reason. I mean, here we are, Earth Day. And part of the reason that Joe Biden has been able to hit the ground running in the states is that even though Donald Trump, thank God that's the first time we've had to mention him for like 100 years now, even though he was a climate change denier, the states weren't.
Yeah.
Within the federal system of the United States, they were still going to, you know, to COP conferences without him. Because there was a different, separate structure there. That's what federation really means. It means a lot of devolved power. Now, apart from endlessly talking about federalism with absolutely no intent to do what Kieran Martin, that you mentioned, the former Constitution Unit chief that masterminded the Edinburgh Agreement, his thing last week pointed out that you would actually need to reverse parliamentary sovereignty as a doctrine in Britain to be able to have federalism.
Yes.
Because it presumes the sovereignty of Westminster. So, you know, just let's not be having this duking in, duking out when you feel like it. And that's just America. I realized I knew just so little about the foundation of Canada, but it was formed from British colonies and French ones that had mostly been ceded over to the British. Mm-hmm. Which came together in self-governing entities. And astonishingly, I didn't really realise that it was only 1931 that Westminster recognised Canada has become co-equal, repatriated the Constitution in 1982 only, and took its legal stuff away from it. So equally, Canada was a construction of British colonies.
Yes.
Now, that is not quite the same. And finally, Spain. I mean, really, do you want to go there, Adam? You know, the constitution that was created in the wake of the death of Franco, you know, that is the death of a dictator whose activities and the civil war that he stoked and preceded has caused just the most extraordinary damage to Spain. There are still bodies being dug from trenches. Right. If you really want to make a parallel there, just knock yourself out. But equally, the reason it's not working is because within that settlement, which was pretty much forced on many of the hitherto independent states, like the Basques, for example, is not working without the rule of state violence, without the application of state violence. That will not hold. So, I mean, it's just a staggeringly sort of, you know, naive argument, really, because it's as if none of us would ever think to look at the points of comparison he's making, for one thing. And for another, just really the idea that you're going to now say, actually, we're just going to force you to stay here forever and change the law to make that possible. And actually, they probably could.
Yeah. Oh, that is entirely what I was about to say. They can. Because a genuinely federal system will have a written constitution which enshrines the role of the state in terms of the executive, and enshrines the role of the federal elements that make that up. And we'll have a Supreme Court that sits there and decides if there are disputes between the federated areas and the central government. Now, as I say, continue the Labour Party goes on about this, and this fantasy that they're going to be getting into power. And how many years, Keir, and how many years, Anas, do you want us to remain under Conservative control? You'll keep looking to that new day tomorrow, which is not going to be coming down the line anywhere quickly. We cannot continue with that, and federalism is not on the cards at all. And
you see, that's an interesting point you made there. Just suddenly it made me think of something, you know, that the mention of the Supreme Court, you know, that when you're going to do what the states have done and Canada, you're going to federate properly and fairly with powers that are indisputable.
Yes.
But still you're going to put above that a court, the Supreme Court, that will end up adjudicating any mm-hmm. disputes that arise. And you think then about all the arguments that we watched being kind of coming out of, it would have to be said, English society about Brexit. And one of the biggest sort of, you know, it seemed to me contrived mm-hmm. hurts that there was about the whole thing was the European Court of Justice.
Yeah.
It's the same thing. It's the notion they just will not tolerate the idea that anything sits above parliamentary sovereignty of Westminster. And if you've got that outlook so bolted into your psyche that you can shift a whole population into an utterly self-damaging Brexit simply because you don't want foreigners wandering around here, point one. And secondly, you don't want, and there's still in it, foreigners with a court somewhere else adjudicating on you.
Mm-hmm.
It demonstrates how much this idea of Westminster ruling the roost is just utterly bolted in to the way Britain works. So, yeah, you know, if you want to change the constitution so that you kind of end up with a you canny leave thing, it's in every case here been done in the context, as you say, of creating a written constitution, which in two of the cases of what you describe are a proper federal system. And actually, even in the case of Spain, one of the reasons I tweeted it this morning that the cleverness of the divide and rule is that the Basques, for example, were divided up into two, or actually, if you had one Basque society, it would be, I think, I can't remember exactly, but I think it would be 4 million people. But it's cunningly split between mm-hmm. a number of different now regions. And they have been given far more powers than the Catalans. So, you know, they have tax raising powers. There's lots of stuff they quibble about, but they have many powers that for a while have managed to keep them at a little bit more of a distance. And of course, they have the violent history of ETA, which has kept a lot of moderate Basques worried about pushing for a Basque government because they don't want to revive the memories of that.
Yeah.
By the way, ETA were formally dissolved in 2018 and the violent campaign ended long before that. So, I know that we're going on, in a sense, too deeply and taking Adam Tompkins far too seriously by even bothering to look at the actual examples he's citing.
Mm-hmm.
But I always think it's just worth knowing how things work in other situations. And they either work by new societies learning from the mistakes of the past, and the biggest single walking mistake on the planet. Well, you could have an argument about state communism within the Soviet bloc, yeah, and so on. But, you know, right up there has been the, you know, winner takes all approach of Britain. That's what everybody who went to new countries didn't reproduce.
Yeah. Well, talking about winner takes all, I mean, it's the aspect is that what we've been moving into, I want to talk about now, is something we picked up on last week with a little mention in community wealth building in the SNP's manifesto, which I had a closer look at. Guy Thin, I would say, about half a dozen lines about moving public procurement into local areas and taking account of tax monies coming back to the taxpayers in these local communities and focusing on small, medium-sized enterprise in terms of public procurement. But you took it a bit more in depth, looking at the Preston model and its origination in Cleveland with Ted Howard, which, you know, I've been a missionary, if you like, for the Preston model, but I wasn't aware of the Ted Howard connection in terms of the initial emphasis in Cleveland that he brought to bear through social enterprises.
Yeah, it seems that, I mean, Cleveland, you know, Rust Belt city, left behind, terrible unemployment rate, all sorts of problems in the United States. And this kind of this guy who is an entrepreneur, but, you know, also an artist, he came into the piece and suggested setting up evergreen cooperatives to be able to work together to create enough muscle in the community to viably take on the contracts which were currently going to out of town based, commercial enterprises that were paying people hee haw and, you know, coming and going. So it's both bits of that equation that are necessary. You definitely need a situation. And this is what the community wealth building bit in the SNP manifesto is, as they do so well, brushing over and mentioning, you know, sort of for a bit of feel good, but not digging into. Well, maybe to be fair, a manifesto can't do all that digging. But the trouble is they've got previous on this mentioning stuff that, you know, just hasn't got the foundations built in for the change. But there's part of it needs to be that if you look at, as you've said, you know, the amount of money that there is in contracts sitting in local areas between hospitals, universities, councils, all these public buildings, institutions, which are run on our taxes, right? And those contracts, because of a best value system that was brought in by Labour in Scotland and mimics a Tory kind of philosophy across Britain that was never dislodged in the Labour years, makes a presumption that the best value is the cheapest offer. Mm-hmm. Now, actually, there's been places all over that have just applied things differently. And the assumption that people have that the EU also precluded you inserting other criteria into contracts is also wrong. If you could say that this was a fair tendering process, you could insert things like Aberdeen did, freshness, which essentially equated into food miles, that allowed lots of local businesses in Aberdeenshire to be able to successfully tender for contracts there because they could obviously really score on food miles, whereas everybody further the parish didn't. You can also put in criteria about skills, training. Yeah. You can put whatever you want in as long as it looks like a fair kind of contract. And that's just what we have not really been bothered to do properly. So what happened in Cleveland was both that the tendering process was opened up to look at the possibility of taking on these evergreen cooperatives, the majority of whose members had a criminal record. And this is the other point of it, that there's one laundry that was set up, an evergreen laundry in 2008, which was set up in a part of Cleveland that was the most deprived, had the highest proportion of people with criminal records or no educational qualifications, and worked in skills training, very careful co-working arrangements to bring folk in. I mean, there's a brilliant piece, I can't remember if it was The Guardian, about this, which interviews one of the leaders, the managers of the laundry, who had a previous prison sentence. She would never have got a job again under normal circumstances. So they've really turned that around. They've got 150 people employed. They're hoping to scale it up to 1,000. They've got a lot of patient capital put in here, which is, again, taking advantage of the American traditions of folk with money thinking they need to do something with it sometimes, albeit that's part of a system that just, you know, allows the majority of people to pay pitiful amounts of tax, you know, so that, you know, maybe that's where the kind of entrepreneurial stuff comes from. But still, they got this patient capital that wasn't looking for a fast buck, basically. Yeah. And put $5 million into this at the beginning, which it's taking to be able to run all of this properly. But the point is, these businesses are washing their faces. They're able to compete with the big boys when they're given a chance at the beginning because of an intention, a determination to use money to try to solve local employment problems and empower people. Now, that's what then was picked up by Preston. And this guy, Howard, was actually over in Preston looking at how Preston is doing today and saying that actually he thinks it's the best application of the principles he had that he's seen anywhere in the world. So credit where credit's due. You know, that's what it takes to make this all work, is not just that you're kind of a willingness by public bodies to consider the little guys that are sitting on the doorstep. Yeah. But the little guys on the doorstep have to get arranged to be able to take over the size of contract. So another issue is the way that the Scottish government have kept agglomerating aspects of contracts to the degree that only the big country, the big boy type operators who have become experts at winning contracts, like Serco, only they can possibly win contracts. So unless the Scottish government is willing to crack down its contracts again so that they're bite-sized enough for Scottish companies to win it, then this is just so much empty talk.
Yeah, and when you add to it that the core of the community wealth building as it's been organised in Preston is progressive procurement. So it's not just the fact of, well, we're going to get the small and medium-sized enterprises the ability to bid for these, but you're going to restructure your economy on the line of positively encouraging and funding the development of cooperatives and employee ownership, taking a look at current ownership models and where they exist. I know this goes on, is going on in Scotland quite quietly, where former family firms, for example, I think Shetland in particular, it's been very interesting, have been encouraged that when the family members are retiring, that they've gone in there and turned them into very successful cooperatives. So it's promotion of cooperatives. It's saying that is the foundation of the way we should actually organise work where we possibly can, where we've got a fairer and more democratic society through where we spend most of our days, which is in work. And to me, that's the progressive element that is currently missing from when you've got that very specific three or four lines in the SNP's manifesto. Alaba do touch on it, and they talk about the creation of a Scotland-wide supply chain and progressive procurement and the encouragement of cooperatives. Similarly with the Greens, they talk about the Scottish government should only be giving contracts to people who are actually fair employers, recognised trade unions, don't have precarious contracts, and pay union rates at the very minimum. So you've got a very different thing going on. And it just worries me about that. This has been a little bit of cherry picking, that buzzword, community wealth building, that looks really interesting. That ticks a little progressive box there, but there's no detail. And they could have easily gone into the detail that the Greens went into it, because there's a lot more involved in that. Even Alaba came up with, I looked through it carefully, yes, tick the box, there's progressive procurement, and tick the box, there's cooperatives. But that was not in there. And it's just very, very disappointing that significant element to the way we live our lives it has been omitted. And it used to be said that you couldn't do this because of European regulations. Well, Preston proved it could be done within the European Union. So if any argument that says if we wish to join the European Union post-independence, this couldn't happen, no, it does happen.
Yeah,
because
just
Preston Council cooperated with the European Commission.
Yeah, absolutely. And just as a matter of fact, the Preston managed to double its spending with local businesses between 2012 and 2016.
Yeah.
Right? Brexit 2016. And the way it did it was it used a weighting system that scored, you know, as I was saying earlier, local labour recruitment. So that when that was viable within EU rules. So that, and the result of this is not just a small thing. In 2018, Britain was declared the most improved city in the UK by an independent report. And the city's unemployment rate has halved at the same time as local procurement has risen in 5 years. Now, the good thing is that there are, I didn't have enough time to sit and scan around every single city and their plans. But if you look at Glasgow, for example, it has done some small pilots on the community wealth building front. And Susan Aitken, the leader, says the council is about to announce a citywide circular economy action plan. And that is where you really start to see that you are an engine for local growth. You're not just, and this is again reflects the problems of a top-down feeling society, which Scotland has not broken from, where you think that the engine of change is always somewhere else. It's always somewhere higher. It's feudal, actually. So, you know, the councils very often feel they haven't got the power and responsibility to be that engine for their own little society. And of course, you know, funding is all top down here, and the arrangements are make it very difficult. But just in the same way as the states in the United States kept the faith despite Trump, it's quite possible for SNP-led councils to just get on with this And I'm looking at Glasgow now and watching what this actually amounts to, because if they can bring a circular economy in, then whatever anybody wants to argue about green recovery, that's the seedbed of it.
Yeah, and the potential is there, because, you know, the vast majority of local authorities, overly large as we know they are, and I noticed that there's some reference to reformation of a reforming of a local government levels and bring it more community-based in the Greens, SNP and ALBA's manifestos. But they are coalitions in the main, and they tend to be, except in some places, coalitions which are progressive, for example, in Fife. You know, you've got Labour and the SNP working together, and I would say sharing values. And that's where we can, as I say, it's a very difficult one, because I know Lorna Slater got into bother about this when she was pushed on the Sunday show about this is not a manifesto for independence. And I think she was misunderstood slightly on that, and Patrick Harvey clarified it today, is that you've got to try and do the best you can within the framework that we currently got while still pushing for independence simultaneously, because we cannot do all that we want just now because of the powers that are retained at Westminster. But there are definitely things that local authorities can do if they have the willingness to examine what happened in Preston and to go out and do it now and make a difference to people's lives now. You know, and that's that duality that I've always got, is the fact that, yeah, I want independence, but do it now.
Yep. Yeah. No arguments.
Phew. Yeah. And moving on, we're going to talk a little bit internationally now, because it was the George Floyd, Derek Chauvin conviction, and he's found guilty on all counts of second degree murder, third degree murder and manslaughter yesterday, unanimously by the jury, and we await the sentencing. And about to happen as well is that the, I think, three or four officers who stood by while Chauvin, and again, I mean, it just, you know, the pit of my stomach sinks when, you know, just that thought of 9.5 minutes and, you know, look, you know, God almighty, and wait, see here, luckily caught on camera. We might never have known what actually happened unless it hadn't been caught on camera, where a man was murdered in front of our eyes. They're being charged with aiding and abetting, and they're about to go on trial as well. So unlike what's happened in previous cases, conviction was achieved. And, you know, will it make any difference? Is this a sea change? Is Biden in the White House about to make a difference? Or will this just be like a Hollywood movie? Yeah, there was a happy ending to this story, and the conviction of Chauvin was achieved. But will it make any difference to the situation of the inappropriate use of violence, which appears to be focused entirely on African-Americans and Latinos and people of colour in the United States of America?
Yeah, because there was a lassie killed the same day as the... Yeah. She was a 16-year-old lass that was killed the same day as the verdict was coming out. And I'd imagine that the thing is, there are absolutely inbuilt defaults of how people operate, how people police, and they obviously don't change, even though there's a big Belisha Beacon sitting in the corner now saying, you know, from here on in, there is increased scrutiny. You know, there is a different kind of default sitting in many parts of the American system. You know, even that very same day, you'd think that would be the day that everybody would be, you know, the way people often are on best behavior when they realize there's a little bit extra scrutiny going on about their part of the world. And yet that didn't happen. I appreciate that may make a lot of people, you know, and validly say, this is the scale of the problems of racism in a society that was set up in many respects in racist ways. You know, this, it often occurs to me how all these quick fixes about the creation of states that look like they make sense at the time. And then we're coming back to the earlier discussion about, you know, the quick fix of the constitution in Spain that has just created no end of trouble. But obviously much more seriously so in the case of the states, you don't outrun it. No. You don't easily outrun it, but you still have to try and fix it. And so obviously from a distance, it just looks kind of crazy, as does the whole gun culture of the states, which facilitates an escalation of all exchanges to become lethal. You know, there's so many ones that situations where if ours was a gun culture in the same way, the same level of difficulty would begin to emerge with every exchange, because we are no strangers to presumptions and to higher levels of lifting Black and ethnic minority kids. You know, the same underlying situations exist, but we haven't got a gun culture that then transforms that into the same incredible number of fatalities that are happening every day and have become part of a sort of normal, shrugged off kind of, it's part of what you get for having the right to bear arms, which again brings you back to the Constitution created at a time of a completely different era, which is still being dragged through the psyche of Americans today. But yeah, I mean, that was such a shock. I'm sorry that I haven't got the lass's name. Have you got it?
No, I haven't. That's I will look it up, because I mean, it is that whole thing of that there were 62 during the Chauvin trial. The New York Times did some research, because this is not nationally retained. There is no analysis done of deaths, of fatal shootings by police officers in the United States. The New York Times did an analysis. During the Chauvin trial, there were 62 deaths where police used fatal force, and in the vast majority of cases, against African-Americans and Latinos. And the other point, it was a way to say as well, you've hit the nail on the head, Leslie, and that's why I think in a new Scotland there has to be a written constitution. That's a written constitution that has to come from the people. If we genuinely believe, and it's not just words, that the people are sovereign in Scotland, it will be the people who should create the constitution. And I think that's absolutely essential, because what we lay down in the beginnings of any new nation, and in terms of its independence, that is with us. That is who we are. And we have got to really decide who we are before we stumble blindly into possibly a recreation of a failed British state, of which Scottish independence is a symptom, and we desire to be short of it. But what we've got to do is look at who we actually want to be and create a constitution that enables us to become that.
Yep, absolutely. I've just looked at this, actually, and the last was called Micaiah Bryant. And what seems to have happened was that it was in the state of Ohio. It seemed that police are saying that she was wielding a knife. She was appearing to lunge at another member of a group with a knife in her hand. The police are saying that they approached the group and shouted, "Get down," before shooting the girl. And the officers heard saying, "She had a knife, she just went at me," whereas a bystander is shouting, "She's just a child."
Yeah.
So it's the same sort of thing again, basically, of if the gun is there, it's going. Yeah. I mean, it's so easy to look from outside and just see things that from inside, you know, the Americans are just tearing themselves apart over a fixed attitude towards what keeps them safe.
Yes.
And, you know, there's many things that are so fixed as kind of presumptions that you just won't question them. And you will bend yourselves as a society completely out of shape, creating all sorts of other problems, rather than look at that initial presumption that you just won't let go of. So it'll be interesting to see, you know, there's many, many, many big tasks that face the Biden administration, and it's great to see that the choice of people, at least in the climate change crisis side of it, are strong people with a very good track record who really have their, you know, are locked on. But whether the gun lobby can really be taken on, and the thinking of this lack of safety that's conveyed by it, which essentially comes down to a lack of a fear of others. Can that actually be done, you know, within one administration? You'd like to think it can. But, I mean, just not to be too gloomy about this, what also strikes me is it wasn't so long ago, and, you know, we need to remember this, that people were predicting Trump would never leave the White House.
Yeah.
So, you know, and people were getting emotionally invested in that, you know, and of course, he wasn't going easily. That's right. But, you know, at all times, democratic processes will run over all of this kind of stuff. So let's keep our emotional investments in the certainty of change, actually, when there is real democratic force behind it. It's boring. Boringly, all the United States voted, they did, for Joe Biden in actually far bigger numbers than anyone expected. But the narrative is still that it was touch and go whether Trump was actually going to be ousted. And it's true that he still left his imprint essentially on many organizations, including the Supreme Court. But still, as goes with independence, it's very important for people to think and believe that once we get the ball rolling, these are a series of decisions that we can take and move with as long as we keep the democratic center of it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And just on a lighter note, you were talking, you're reflecting back, and I've been saving it to the end of the podcast, is that you're talking about procurement and it going to the cheapest offer. That Neil Armstrong was actually asked what was his last thoughts as they were about to blast off for the moon on the Apollo mission. He says, "Well, I suddenly realized I was sitting on top of an explosive device that should have been entirely designed and built by people who'd put in the cheapest proposals to build it." And he said that was his last thought before he went off. Not a very positive one. But it's a lovely, bright, sunny day. And I started off feeling, suffering, as I said, from election ennui. But coming back to focus on it, that, as you said, Leslie, democracy is central. Democracy takes place every day in every action that we take as citizens within our trade unions, and not just when we vote. So there's lots and lots and lots of action that we can take to ensure the kind of society we want to see, that we don't have kids living in poverty. And I've often said it to you, Leslie, the reason I think I'm a socialist goes right back to my early days as a wee boy at St Mary's Forbank Primary School at the Health Town, and seeing my pals coming to school without shoes in winter in the 1950s. And I knew it was wrong then, and bearing suffering, it's wrong now. So, and in hopes of a brighter future, and hopes we'll see you next week, chums.
Oh, and just one final thing that we should remember to say every time. Thanks to everyone who has subscribed to the podcast. We really appreciate that. And the conversation Pat and I are about to have, once we hit the stop button on this, is which should be the subject of our next extra podcast. So one of those will be coming soon.
Woohoo! Cheery bye.